So this is Rod Adams, and it's time for Atomic Show number 185. And with me today, I have Kirk Sorensen, the co-founder and chief technology officer of Flybe Energy, and Rick Martin, the author of Superfuel, which is a book that focused on the potential of thorium as a new reactor technology. Welcome to you both.
Thanks, Rod.
Thanks a lot, Rod. Good to be back.
Yeah, and for those of you who are regular listeners, Kirk and I had a discussion last week. As luck would have it, the difficulty of getting three busy people in the same place at the same time left us without Rick, who we wanted to have as a guest of honor. But I hope most of you enjoyed the conversation resulted. I always enjoy exchanging ideas with Kirk, and it's fun for me to get involved in intellectual challenges. So one of the reasons that I invited Richard onto the show was as the author of Superfuel. I wrote a review of that book, and I was a little bit critical about what I considered to be some of the slants against the existing nuclear technology. As one of the nuclearati who's been operating and thinking about reactors since about 1980, I was a little bit taken aback by the portrayal of some of the achievements of the light water reactor. So, Rick, I'd like to let you talk a little bit about what you discovered in your research for Superfuel.
Well, sure. And one thing I have to say, Rod, was in reading your comments, which obviously I really appreciate and value your experience and your seriousness about these issues and your knowledge and expertise on the technology. But there seemed to be a paradox in that Superfuel is about the potential for nuclear power to really play a much larger role than it currently does in our power generation, and in fact, to help avert catastrophic climate change. And so I think to some degree, you and I are on the same page in believing that nuclear power in the larger sense does have an important role to play going forward. My feeling about the current nuclear power industry is simply that it has failed to live up to the promise that was foreseen back in the time of the birth of the industry back in the late 40s and 1950s, when, as you know, the one of the most famous quotes was that nuclear power would deliver electricity too cheap to meter. And obviously it hasn't done that. And it's really, in, at least in the United States, it's been stuck on about 20% of our power generation for a long time. And essentially no new nuclear plants have come online in a few decades. And the way I put it in the book is, if you compare it to the information technology industry, which I'm very familiar with and I've been writing about for many years, and you look at the innovation and the advancements that have taken place in IT over the last, let's say, 30 years or so, looking at nuclear power, it's as if we were all still using Atari 800 computers from about 1982. And the much talked about nuclear renaissance, from where I sit, has been to date largely a matter of uprating existing reactors and licensing them beyond their original lifespans, which doesn't sound like a recipe for a truly innovative and thriving industry to me. So while I believe that, you know, powerful technology will find a way to benefit the world and to grow and to prosper in a financial and economic sense, to a large degree, at least since about 1980, that hasn't happened in the nuclear power industry. And that I find that frustrating. And the reason I got excited about thorium power is that I believe it can answer a lot of the concerns that people have about existing nuclear plants and can really carry us forward into an energy future that is much less reliant on fossil fuels.
Well, one of the problems I had with your commentary, though, is it seemed to ignore the fact that nuclear has been strongly resisted, and that many of the challenges that current nuclear power plants face are not a result of technology failures or not a result of even technology risks. They're simply a result of a focused, organized effort to hamstring nuclear as tightly as possible, to tie it down with as many Lilliputian strings as possible. And I believe that a large part of that is the result of typical competitive instincts by the existing market-dominant players. The fossil fuel industry certainly does not like the idea of electricity too cheap to meter and does not like the idea of losing market share to this upstart that was only discovered within the lifetime of people who are still extant today.
Rod, would it be okay if I said something or suggested
Absolutely.
Something really
Go
quick?
Ahead.
I think what we've done is we've kind of jumped right in the middle of this, and there may be for listeners who are tuning in for the first time, perhaps a little bit of preface that may be necessary to talk about what superfuel is and why thorium and fluoride reactors are perceived as having an advantage in the first place. I think we kind of skipped over that part.
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, well, Rick, would you want to talk about this, or would you like me to talk about it?
Why don't you go first, Kirk?
Okay. Well, Superfuel, which is a book that I was interviewed for and I've strongly endorsed on my site, is a book that talks about the history of thorium as a nuclear alternative fuel. And in particular, the author, Rick Martin, of course, who's with us, is does a great job talking about how thorium was kind of always in the shadow of uranium. And while it had particular advantages for nuclear power generation, it was not developed to the degree that uranium-based solid fuel reactors were. And he spends a considerable amount of time exploring the events surrounding the development of the molten salt reactor at Oak Ridge National Laboratory in the 1950s and the 60s under Dr. Alvin Weinberg. And this is where thorium fuel and a very efficient technology for utilizing thorium fuel were first combined. And while they were not demonstrated to a commercial level, they were demonstrated to a level that showed that there was material compatibility, there was physical compatibility, and the promise was there. But it was not realized because of the U.S.'s focus on the fast breeder reactor in the 1970s. And other reactor technologies were cut, including the molten salt reactor and the thorium fuel cycle. Later in the 1970s, a thorium-fueled light water reactor was demonstrated at the Shippingport reactor under the auspices of Admiral Rickover, and it showed that thorium was able to indeed breed in a thermal neutron spectrum. And the significance of that is that all of our reactors today use thermal neutron spectra, so that was a great accomplishment. But nevertheless, research and interest in thorium had dropped off precipitously until the last few years, when a groundswell of people, on their own time and usually on their own money, have been promoting the use of thorium, particularly in the molten salt reactor, as a solution to many of our challenges that we face today. And Rick's book focuses some attention on this and talks about how this could potentially be a prospect for the future. But it has been fairly unsparing in its criticism of the existing way we do nuclear energy, which I think has led to this discussion between Rod Adams, who's somebody I just tremendously admire, and Rick Martin, who's somebody else I tremendously admire. So I'm happy to be part of it.
Okay.
So let me just follow up on that, Kirk, and talk a little bit about the groundswell, which I've witnessed just in the 3.5 to 4 years that I've really been focused on this story. When you and I first met, it was back in 2009, when I was working on a feature story for Wired magazine on what I've come to call the thorium revival. And as you know, at that time, it really was a bunch of individuals, a bunch of outsiders who were sort of beating their heads against the wall of this established industry and trying to really bring some innovation to bear on some of the problems that have hamstrung the industry. And since that time, I've really watched this revival, this movement grow into a much more expansive and inclusive movement that it includes real businesses raising real money with real political support in some countries and real R&D efforts being made that are carrying this technology forward. 2 weeks ago, I was in London at the invitation of the Weinberg Foundation, which, as you know, is a nonprofit that was started over there by a group of thorium advocates headed by the Baroness Bryony Worthington, who's a member of the House of Lords. And I spoke at Cambridge University, and the afternoon before I spoke, we had a roundtable that included business leaders, Cambridge professors, technologists. There was a guy from Rolls-Royce there. The sort of guest of honor was David Mackey, who's helping to head up the British government's exploration of future forms of nuclear power and power generation more generally, who's very well versed in the potential for thorium power and so on. And it really brought home to me how far this movement and this technology has traveled in 3 short years. And so I really do think that groundswell is an appropriate term, and it's been quite remarkable to see. And if you think about what's going on in places like China and India, there's been a lot of news out of China in the last year or so about the government-supported R&D program to really, you know, build a prototype liquid fluoride thorium reactor within the next few years. And one of the major thorium conferences, the ITO conference, is going to be held in Shanghai in the fall. And I think that will really be, I hesitate to use the term, but could represent a tipping point for the thorium revival. So it's definitely happening. Whether it will happen in the United States is, I think, still an open question. But, you know, the thorium revival is inevitable, and the only question for me is whether the U.S. is going to be a leader or a follower.
Well, one of the challenges I have for both of you is I understand the excitement about thorium and the potential that thorium has to play a role in the world's energy markets. But as exciting as it is that China is investing a little bit of money into a R&D project that involves thorium, to me, as someone who's very concerned about the dangers of climate change, the thing that's really exciting is the fact that China is building right now 25 large light water reactors that will be heated by uranium, and has plans on the books to add about 400 gigawatts between now and 2050, mostly with uranium-fueled light water reactors. And the challenge that I have is that, you know, we in the U.S. and in Western Europe haven't built very many new reactors in the last 30 years. Well, I shouldn't say in the U.S. it's been 30 years, and in Europe it's been more like in the last 20 years. But there's been a tremendous amount of development in South Korea and in Japan and in China of light water reactors, real reliable, safe, and low operating cost reactors. You know, even in the U.S., our light water reactor fleet is doing an amazing job of producing affordable electricity with no emissions.
So let me answer that briefly, Kirk, and then I'm going to give way to you. And the thing is, Rod, I pretty much agree with almost everything you just said. And believe me, I totally agree that anything China does besides build coal-fired plants is good for China, it's good for the United States, it's good for the world. So I'm very happy to see that, because let's face it, if China doesn't harness its emission problems over the next 30 years, it doesn't matter what the rest of the world does. So anything that substitutes nuclear power in general for fossil fuel power generation in China is a great thing. But the thing is, we are facing, you know, if I can use the term we to refer to anyone who is promoting low or zero carbon emitting forms of power generation, we do face a public perception problem in Western Europe and the United States. And it's not going to go away, and it's certainly not going to go away in the wake of Fukushima. And one of the reasons I'm so excited about the potential of thorium power is simply that it can answer almost all of the objections to nuclear power that are raised by, you know, anti-proliferation activists, by environmentalists, and so on. And you know, there's a whole question of the uranium supply, which I know is a hotly debated topic. And certainly the price of uranium is going to start to climb if even, you know, a fraction of the reactors worldwide that are on the drawing board come online. And so I think there's perception problems, there's economic problems with continuing down the path we're on. And I like what Kirk told me once about the aftermath of Fukushima. He compared it to the asteroid that struck the Earth and killed off the dinosaurs. And what he was saying was that more than ever, it's going to be very tough to build conventional light water uranium-based reactors because people simply don't trust them. And we're watching countries get out of nuclear power, far from adding to the nuclear power fleet. We're watching it contract.
Yeah, but wait a minute, Rick. And part of the reason that I believe that it's time for us to talk is that the perception problem that nuclear has didn't come out of thin air. It came from a very carefully paid-for, focused advertising campaign to prevent people from recognizing that nobody got hurt by radiation emitted from Fukushima, not one single person. So why is this a catastrophe? Yes, their plants were damaged, but they were hit by the fourth largest earthquake recorded in human history and a 15-meter tall tsunami that knocked out the backup generators.
Why did this happen? Because cesium was released from the reactors and is contaminating the area around there. Now, I know
wait a minute. Are you going to tell me that a thorium-based reactor does not produce cesium?
I will say it's locked up. It's a fluoride. It's not volatile like it is in oxide chemistry, and it's not driven by high pressure to be released from the system. There is a basic difference between the kind of machine we're talking about and the kind of machine we have today. Now, yes, this was an incredible, it was an unlikely event, but nevertheless, that cesium-134 and 137 is out there. Now, I know.
Now, who's it hurt? Who has it hurt?
Rod, it doesn't matter.
Why?
You know, it is the public perception of these things. You and I both know that most of the contamination area around Fukushima represents a lower radiation level than most places on Earth. Now, I mean, Rod, I would love if the world was full of engineers who could be convinced by logical arguments and numbers. But we have to remember, most people are not like us. They do not get swayed by numbers or explanations. They are swayed by fear. And
they're swayed by advertising.
How is the advertising conveyed? Through fear. You know, they are told a story, and the story is, be afraid, be very afraid. All right, so that's the hand we're dealt with. Now, I've noticed in your discussion, you use the word nuclear, I think, as a synonym for light water reactors.
No, I use the word nuclear for a synonym for fission, which is the new fire. And it doesn't matter to me what the fuel source is, whether it's uranium, thorium, or plutonium. What I care about is an alternative to combustion that does not release any atmospheric contaminants and that is 2 million times as concentrated, so the fuel source, the potential fuel source, will last human society for several millennia.
Absolutely, and we are in complete agreement on that subject.
Exactly. No one has an argument with that.
Okay, what we do have, and I think I agree with what Rick said and what he particularly what he said before about how nuclear technology should have developed. No one ever anticipated that the light water reactor would be the basis of our nuclear technology. I've got the reports from the 50s and 60s, even in the dawn of the nuclear age, the light water reactor was seen as a stopgap
by
in
scientists. Between machines. By scientists, but not by engineers.
No, plenty of engineers saw it that way too, Rod. I mean, it's your Navy background. I mean, it's tremendous. But there were nobody saw the light water reactor as the machine on which we would power our civilization using nuclear power for thousands of years. The only question is which breeder and how fast do we get to it? I mean, I got a 1962 report to the president, and right in there it states, you know, this is a we did it, but it's a stopgap technology. I think these early nuclear pioneers would be absolutely floored to show up today in our nuclear world and go, oh my gosh, you're still using light water reactors? I mean, come on, guys. It's like Von Braun showing up and finding out Marshall Space Flight Center is still talking about building a giant expendable rocket. I mean, he'd probably, like, immolate himself right there. You know, it's just not the way the future was supposed to turn out. And I think what Rick was saying, and I don't want to put words in his mouth, but I think what he's saying is we should have seen more technology advancement by now. We should have seen something better. Why didn't it happen?
And well, let me add to that. You know, you talked about risk and fear, and the last chapter of my book is mostly about risk. And economic financial markets are driven by risk. And the reason, one of the biggest reasons that we haven't seen the level of innovation in nuclear technology that we have in other forms of technology is that the market will not invest in it because of the perceived risk. And whether that risk is real or not, to some extent, doesn't matter. And Rod, let me assure you that the fossil fuel industry did not cause Chernobyl. The fossil fuel industry did not cause the tsunami that washed over the Fukushima reactors.
No, but they sure paid for the advertising during the media frenzy that occurred after Fukushima, and people were trying to figure out what was happening, and the media kept focusing on the minor amounts of cesium release and completely ignored the fact that there was a refinery that was burning and dumping toxic materials into the atmosphere for 10 solid days after the accident.
You're absolutely right.
That was completely ignored, except for the fact that CNN talked about the Fukushima nuclear reactor accident with the burning embers of the LNG facility in the background as if that was the reactor.
It was. And Rod, you know, the media's job is not to inform us or educate us. It's to put eyeballs on the TV to sell advertising. Now, when a tsunami comes and washes over 15,000 people, from their perspective, oh, darn, a bunch of people died. But if they can keep you scared to death and keep your eyeballs on the screen with toxic radiation heading your way, you know, stay tuned. I mean, that is a story. And it's funny because smart people around the world, in some cases, have been I remember a story on BBC where they had somebody who said, I was anti-nuclear, but when I watched the way they covered this, I started asking questions, and I found out this was completely slanted. This was completely one-sided. You know, we were told we were being told to tell an incorrect story. I mean, that's just scary.
But we're focusing on, in this conversation, on a media conspiracy, and I don't think that's necessarily where you know, nuclear technologists need to focus their energy and their attention. Why not focus it on a fuel that has some indisputable advantages? It is four times as abundant. It's not fissile. It's fertile. You have to bombard it with neutrons to get it to fission. You know, it is far safer to transport and store. The waste issue is much easier to deal with, particularly in the kind of liquid fuel reactors that Kirk is trying to create. So I just, when we get caught up in either highly technical arguments or, you know, questions about who's paying the media to cover it in a certain way, I think you're ignoring the sort of elephant in the room that we all agree that nuclear power should be developed further, and why not go with a new fuel that can answer virtually all the objections that are on the table?
Well, Rick, one of the things that you may not know about me is that I left the Navy in 1993 full of vim and vigor, having developed and patented a control system associated with a high-temperature gas reactor that also answered all of the objections that people have about nuclear fission. The reactor would be inherently safe because of testing. The AVR, which is a German prototype of the high temperature gas reactor, actually demonstrated that it could go through a complete anticipated transient without scram and not overheat. The HTR-10, which is a Chinese edition of the AVR, has demonstrated that, and I've got the video to prove it, and people who watched the demonstration themselves. Okay, I spent 3 years working to try to develop the capital base to pursue this high-temperature gas reactor technology. And what I did was I spent a lot of time talking to investors and making presentations. And I'm not talking – and then I ended up, you know, running a small plastic manufacturing business to put food on the table. But I'm not talking about a media conspiracy, and I'm not talking about a conspiracy at all. I'm talking about the traditional behavior of the people that have market share to work very hard to raise the barriers to entry to the potential competitors for that market. And I also recognize very clearly the incredible amount of installed capacity and installed capital that is associated with any existing technology. You're a high-tech writer. I know that you've probably heard of the controversy between germanium and silicon in terms of what's a better semiconductor material. And germanium has a tremendous number of advantages over silicon. However, what do we still use in semiconductors today?
Right. And the description you just gave of an established industry with a lot of sunk capital erecting competitive barriers, to me, that perfectly describes the existing nuclear power industry.
Yeah, but the nuclear power industry, as you said, only has 20% of the electricity market and almost no markets outside of that, with the exception of naval ships. But, you know, the existing competitive energy market is not the nuclear market. It's, and in fact, one of the things that's disadvantaging nuclear today is not that nuclear's costs have suddenly gone out of control, but that people say, wait a minute, we've got all this cheap natural gas, what do we need nuclear for?
Right, and what I've said, what I've been saying in my public talks on superfuel is that the equation that I see really moving the needle and helping us to avoid disastrous climate change is NP plus NG, nuclear power plus natural gas. And you're right that the low cost of natural gas is disadvantaging every other form of power generation. And again, it's better to build natural gas plants than it is to build coal. But in my view, this sort of artificial temporary natural gas glut that has, you know, lowered the prices to record lows
in North America.
Exactly, is giving us some breathing room to think in a more clear and concentrated way about really developing a new power system. And whether we'll be able to take advantage of that, I don't know. But to say that we need to stick with a technology, a fuel source that has been hamstrung in the ways you describe, whatever the, you know, sort of underlying causes of that are, it just doesn't make sense to me that we're going to say, well, let's just go back to a 40-year-old technology and let's stick with uranium despite its proven disadvantages. I don't see the logic in that.
Well, wait, you know, first of all, I and again, as a disclosure, my full-time day-to-day job is developing a new generation of smaller light water reactors that have a tremendous number of technical advances over the existing light water reactors and will approach the condition of being completely passively safe. Now, you know, there's a tremendous amount of technology that can be developed on the light water reactors, and you know that. But I'm not saying that we should avoid or eliminate or even discourage the development of thorium. What I'm saying is that we should be careful about criticizing and aiming thorium as the replacement to nuclear, why not aim it as another way of nuclear, so that we can replace all emissioning combustion systems, not just replace coal, but replace natural gas, replace oil in places like ships? Why are we limiting ourselves to just electricity production?
I actually think, Rod, that is kind of what we're saying. I mean, and Rick, just so you know, I mean, Rod and I go way back. He has been a consistent supporter of thorium and all other fuels for many, many years.
Where did you read about thorium?
Rick, Rod was the first person who ever told me through some readings on his website about the most important feature of thorium in my mind, which is its ability to breed enough fuel in a thermal spectrum reactor to replace that which is consumed. I read that on Rod's site, and I still consider it one of the turning points in my life, was to learn that fact. So, you know, Rod knows that I'm permanently indebted to him. So, but I think perhaps, gentlemen, we might just be talking past each other just a bit here, because the point Rick is making is nuclear, unfortunately, is in recession right now. I mean, just today I was reading World Nuclear News, and the Belgian government had agreed to a shutdown scenario for over 50% of their electrical generation in Belgium, which is based on pressurized light water reactors. And Rod, you know, we've got some new builds going on in the U.S. We've got Vogel, which is AP1000s. We've got TVA, which is looking at putting your B&W M-Power reactors on the Clinch River site. And I hope all those things happen. But even if they all do, we are still losing ground. And so if we can get new nuclear developed and out there, we're going to need all of it. You know, we are really, really going to need all of it. And I think a lot of our excitement about thorium is its potential to have a radically improved fuel efficiency perspective and waste reduction perspective, because we know that has been a very potent line that anti-nuclear forces have used. You know, when you tell people a machine is going to make something that's poisonous for millions of years, isn't that awful? You know, yeah, wow, yeah, I'm against that. What is it? Well, never mind. It's bad, right? Yeah, it's bad. You know, you have to have a few lessons in nuclear engineering before you start going, oh, wait, there's something you can do with that. And wow, you can actually make good things from that. And okay, yeah, that's a little more, there's a little more to it than just that first blush of fear and uncertainty and doubt.
Right. And you don't need lessons in nuclear engineering to recognize that. I mean, Gwyneth Cravens is not a nuclear engineer. Mark Linus is not a nuclear engineer. George Monbiot, Stuart Brand, Barry Brook, you know, I can name a whole bunch of folks that are being turned to the idea that fission has advantages over combustion, and that we do have an awful lot of uranium available. Yes, thorium is four times as prevalent, and yes, it will help us to make it so that we will never have a fuel crisis ever in human history if we can develop both of these sources. But why would we avoid the use of uranium? And, you know, Rick talked about uranium supply. Well, I live about 40 miles from a deposit of 119 million pounds of uranium, and it's right at the surface in an easy to mine area. It's right next to a major highway, easy to move to market. But the person who owns that deposit has been told for 30 years that it's illegal to mine that uranium in the state of Virginia, a state that has 147 licensed coal mines. Now, there's an awful lot of other places where uranium has been put off limits. Australia had a three mines policy for 30 years. The U.S. just put some of our richest uranium deposits off limits because they're within a few miles of the Grand Canyon, but you know, can't be seen from the Grand Canyon. You know, it is, yes, there is opposition to nuclear, and we have to do something to address that. But I really believe that you sometimes are ignoring the fact that if thorium started succeeding, do you think that you won't run into opposition?
No, you're right. You're right, Rod.
Absolutely.
They'll change tactics.
And I think we're sort of setting this up as a false opposition, right? It's not an either-or situation. And I totally agree that we need to bring nuclear power online as quickly as possible. And to a large degree, in the near term, that's going to be uranium. But I do believe that the industry is, I like Kirk's description, the industry is in a recession. And I believe that's true economically. I believe it's true technologically. And we need to leapfrog. We need new, exciting possibilities that are going to turn more people into Stewart brands, as it were, and convince more people of the potential to really supply, you know, safe, clean energy over hundreds, if not thousands of years. And I think the way you do that is you bring on truly innovative technology as opposed to incremental steps on 40-year-old technology,
well,
using
maybe
a fuel that is discredited in many people's minds, like it or not.
Well, let's put it this way. Let's do it in addition to, because first of all, the most important thing that the nuclear industry needs today to be able to sustain a future is it needs good, secure, well-paying jobs for kids to see that there is a future. Right now, there's a reason to study nuclear technology today so that they can, in fact, be employed, work really hard, learn a really rewarding but challenging technology, and keep being employed. And the way that the industry will be able to support the innovation is the same way that the high-tech industry supports innovation, by producing products that serve a purpose today, so you can make money and turn that money back into the future. You know, I think the biggest challenge the nuclear industry's had is it's always been led by people who, for some reason, think that the government is the source of funds.
I totally agree with you.
Yeah, Rod. I mean, you've earned your stripes in the atomic entrepreneurialism business, and that, as we were talking about last time, that is a very, very small cadre of us. But you know, I'm in complete agreement with you. And you pointed out before, too much of what was done in the past was done by companies that had huge investments in their fossil fuel business and never wanted their nuclear to get too good.
I mean,
and the other way that the IT industry has thrived is by making significant funding available to people who had great innovative and risky ideas, like, let's say, Kirk Sorensen. And so that's the other thing that I think is missing. If you're Vinod Khosla and you're one of the most prominent venture capitalists in Silicon Valley, the likelihood of you deciding, I'm going to put my clean energy fund toward existing nuclear technology, is very low. The likelihood of you finding out about liquid fuel thorium reactors and a company like Flybe Energy and saying, this is something that has a real future, this is something that's going to give me the returns that I expect on a venture investment, then that's the direction we need to go. And I think, again, you get back to the conditions of the market and where the money is going to flow. And that's another aspect of thorium power that is quite exciting. And I believe it's exciting to potential investors when they hear about it as well.
Well, agreed that a guy like Vinod Khosla would want the innovation, but there's other investors in the world, like Jeffrey Immelt, for example, or Warren Buffett, who want an investment in something that is a little less risky and a little closer to revenue, and to being able to pay back the investment, not quickly necessarily, but reliably for a long period of time. And part of the challenge I have for you, Rick, is that, you know, you had a line in your book that said, you know, there's no sense in developing thorium unless you shut down existing nuclear. I went, what? Well, wait a minute. You know, the reality is that there is a perception problem, but perception is not reality, despite what people think. And if people who know what reality is allow perception to be unchallenged, you know, sometimes we deserve what we get, but we should be challenging this perception that, first of all, uranium has a limited future. It, you know, we are not doing a very good job yet, but we're not throwing the stuff away. We're you know, putting it away for future generations. We're storing it carefully in well-designed containers that make it easy to get to if somebody comes up with a way to use it better. And Kirk, you're reading Plentiful Energy, and you realize that the guys who are working on the integral fast reactor have just as much heartache with the focus on the oxide-fueled loop reactor at Clinch River as you do. I mean,
I agree.
Fast reactor does not equal fast reactor, right?
And can I tell you something, Rod, that I think is just really, really neat about what you've done? You were the first person I ever read who had a blog that was pro-nuclear. And I still remember reading your site in the very earliest days of me learning about this in 2000 and just sensing your enthusiasm and feeling your passion for this topic. And I still remember thinking, oh my gosh, there's more than one way to do nuclear. I never even knew that until I read your site, Rod. And your passion has definitely infected me. You know, I feel like in some ways I'm an intellectual offspring from your efforts. Because I have caught the fire, and I caught it in large part from you. And I think you're absolutely right that we've got to get people realizing that this is one of the greatest discoveries humanity's ever made. Fission is the new fire. And maybe it will take generations before humanity accepts how marvelous this gift is and truly realizes it. I hope it doesn't take that long. But, you know, we're in it for a long game here. You know, this is a new era in the human experience, realizing a form of energy millions of times more dense than anything we've known before. It's frustrating right now to see what appears to be the glacial pace of progress. But if you pull back on the camera, I mean, think about it, Rod. 12 years ago, other than you, how many people were talking about nuclear on the internet? I can't think of many. Maybe John Wheeler. Now how many people are talking about nuclear? Thousands and thousands of people. That's a great accomplishment. And I think you have you get a lot of the credit for that.
Well, and unfortunately, we don't have generations, right? We've got to do something that's going to take effect here in the next 20 to 30 years. And Rod, I would definitely quarrel with your characterization of conventional nuclear power as a safe, reliable investment. If that's true, why isn't Wall Street investing in it? But I do think that, again, just to reemphasize, you know, we should be developing new nuclear plants. And if the first wave is going to be some updated form of uranium-based nuclear power, that's great. But certainly thorium has to play a role in any revival, in any so-called nuclear renaissance, or it's not going to happen. And I think that's, you know, the discussion, hopefully. Let me put it to you this way. I'd love to reconvene this conversation in about 6 months, and hopefully we'll have some more positive news to report on the nuclear front, and we'll be able to see a little more clear path ahead.
Well, one of the challenges that I have, first of all...
And with I actually have to wrap up, Rob.
Okay. Let me give you one quick, if you can stay with me, just for about 3 minutes. I'm not sure why people keep saying, well, why won't Wall Street invest in it? And because Wall Street's record of investment over the last 10 years has not been exactly stellar. The Wall Street investment selections have often been in terrible investments, like, you know, collateralized debt obligations. So, you know, Wall Street is not the best source of investment advice. You know, there's a lot of other and you know, like I said, I work for a company that is investing tens of millions of dollars a year of its own money in developing the next generation of nuclear power plants for the U.S. And I hope that there's dozens of other companies that decide that that's a way to build to the future, because I really believe that the natural gas prices are only temporarily low. I predict by 2014 that we're going to see $10 per million BTU natural gas in the United States, and that's going to really cause some discontent. So anyway, Rick, thank you very much for coming.
Thanks, Rick.
Yeah, thanks very much for hosting us, Rod. And like I said, I hope we can continue the conversation in the future.
Absolutely.
Thanks, Kurt.
Bye-bye.
So long.
All right, Kirk, it's you and me, and I'm just going to say thank you for your kind words.
Oh, it's me that needs to thank you, Rod. You've had a formative influence on my life. So, yep. Sure, you don't want to talk about a few more things?
Or? Well, okay. Well, I will tell you one of the most influential books that I've ever read. Influenced my thought processes on the energy business was a book written in 1991 by Daniel Yergin called The Prize, The Quest for Oil, Money, and Power.
I've been meaning to read that book.
If you want to understand the energy business, I can't tell you a better way to start. And then if you want to continue your education, I highly recommend books like Oil by Upton Sinclair, or reading some of the Ida Tarbell books about the way that the Rockefeller dynasty was developed, and really understand what it is we're up against. As a naval officer and a guy who studied national strategic policy and economic geography and a whole bunch of other topics other than engineering, it is so obvious to me that, you know, there is serious, well-organized strategic effort being, it's not necessarily the people that most of us think of as people involved in the petroleum industry, because, you know, we're engineers and we went to school with people and there may be petroleum engineers and stuff, but we don't know the marketers, or at least you don't know the marketers.
Yeah, but let's think for a moment about that, because your Navy background taught you this. I have come to appreciate, the older I get, just how rare the capability for strategic thought is. You know, those who think strategically generally don't even think about the fact they do it. They do it like they breathe, you know. They just think strategically about all kinds of things, and they don't perceive how unstrategic most people are. Most people don't think strategically about almost anything. And so, you know, if people thought strategically, you know, people wouldn't smoke and people wouldn't be overweight and a whole bunch of other things.
I guarantee you that if you don't think strategically, you will never become a leader in an organization like a major oil company
any. These people who do think strategically tend to find recompense. They tend to find positions that reward their capability for strategic thought. Would you agree with me so far?
Yep.
You know, I mean, whether that position is naval officer or head of an oil company or a variety of other things. But what I have found amazing is how many people I've found in positions where that person should absolutely be a strategic thinker. I mean, this person should be thinking strategy from the moment they get up to the moment they go to bed, and you don't see any strategic thought. Unfortunately, this is a quality I have found too common in the leadership of our energy sector, in a variety of different aspects in the leadership of our energy sector.
Well, and just look at how little the energy business in general spends on research and development. It's something on the order of 0.5% of their revenue on research and development. And part of the reason I highly recommend The Prize, and you got to pay real close attention when you read it, there's a really interesting vignette, and I can't remember exactly which oil company it was and which time frame it was, but there's a period where a bunch of geologists have discovered that there's a tremendous reservoir of oil, I believe, in the UAE. And they went and they went and presented this notion to their CEO, and the CEO said, "Well, we're certainly not going to invest there." And the geologists were completely flabbergasted. They said, "But we were sure that there is oil here." And the CEO said, "If you could guarantee me that there wasn't oil, I'd give you a few dollars to spend there. But if you find oil there, I can't sell it. I have no markets available for that oil to come into. If you find oil there, all it will do will drive down the price and upset the Saudis."
Okay. I haven't read The Prize, but I'm reading Twilight in the Desert, which is all about the depletion of Saudi oil fields. So this is very interesting.
That's an important book, too, but I highly recommend Twilight in the Desert. Sleeping with the Devil.
Oh, I read that one. Boy, was that a good book.
Yeah.
Oh, boy.
I mean, if you understand economics and the law of supply and demand, and you realize just how inelastic the demand for oil is. You know, people, once they get to a certain point, if the price of gasoline drops, they're not going to go out and drive 10 times more or even 10% more. They're already driving as much as they want to drive.
Yeah,
they'll take that money
though,
and spend
Rod,
it on something else.
How does this relate to nuclear? Because nuclear right now is entirely in the electricity space of energy, whereas oil is almost entirely in the transportation space of energy.
Okay,
so,
but let's look at the history of electricity in the U.S. In 1978, oil was 17% of the U.S. electricity market.
Yeah, now it's probably like what,
1.5 million barrels of oil a day were being burned in U.S. electricity plants. Today, it's a few hundred thousand barrels of oil a day, and mostly in Alaska and Hawaii and Puerto Rico. And what pushed oil out of the U.S. electricity market?
But
what,
I have to say, does it matter, though, the fact we're driving so much more now that whatever oil consumption was freed up by moving electricity off oil-fired has been more than consumed in the growth of automobiles and driving?
Right, but how long did that take? From 1986 until 2000, 15 years, the price of oil was under $25 a barrel after having been above $40 a barrel.
Yeah,
in the early 1980s.
I'm remembering reading
Sleeping
with the Devil. 15
years of low energy prices, and it took 15 years of low energy prices to get the U.S. consumer to start buying SUVs and pickup trucks and all that stuff to soak up all that extra oil. And it wasn't just the U.S. I mean, what do you think was supplying the electricity in Japan before they built 54 nuclear plants? And what do you think is supplying the electricity today?
In the U.S. right now, though, it's coal overwhelmingly that's providing the electricity. Now gas is moving in a big way, and I agree with you. Gas prices, I think, are heading up, not down. I mean, I've been looking at some of the latest counts of the drilling that's going on, the active drilling. I mean, everything points to gas prices going up, 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 up in the next 2 years, and everybody who's switching to gas being caught pretty flat-footed by that.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, in this electricity space where nuclear predominantly, not exclusively, but predominantly operates, the story is coal and gas.
Well, of course, and gas doesn't come from any company other than the oil companies, right? I mean,
well, but
gas
and
oil
are essentially indigenous resources. I mean, the coal we burn in the United States, like, I don't know, probably 99% of it comes from the United States. The gas burn, probably 99.9% of it comes from the United States. So in the electricity space, we are burning indigenous resources. We're not burning import. It's in transportation where we're burning imports.
Transportation and space heating and a number of other. I mean, you know, some of the complexity is for in the Northeast U.S., there was a time when we were building lots of new nuclear plants and getting to the point where people were going back and saying, you know, this oil furnace that I have is a real pain in the neck to have to, you know, bring a tank in and get it filled up every winter, and I never know what the price is going to be, and maybe I'll just, you know, put in a really cheap electric furnace. And electric furnaces, by the way, are pretty cheap. Or I'm going to put in a, you know, a heat pump.
Yeah, it can augment the electrical performance of the
Well,
heat pump.
I mean, I lived in an all-electric home in Maryland, and I still live in an all-electric home. There is no gas where I live because a heat pump is pretty good in the mid-Atlantic. But a competitor to heat pumps is oil heat. And, you know, you have Oil Heat Institute of Long Island actually paid for some of the ads that were
Shoreham.
Against Shoreham. And the ad said solar, not Shoreham, of course, paid for by the Oil Heat Institute of Long Island.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I totally agree with
this
you.
This is a long time thing.
You and I think we're together in D.C., and we saw those ads on the Metro for clean natural gas, and it was like, you know, shortly after the terrible explosion in San Bruno, California, that, you know, was apocalyptic. Mm-hmm. Brought to you by natural gas, but nobody talked about that.
Well, nobody talked about the fact that the explosion at Deepwater Horizon was not by oil. It was natural gas that blew up.
The explosion of the Upper Big Branch coal mine.
The Upper Big Branch
gas.
Coal mine was big up was natural gas. Most people have never even heard of Middletown, Connecticut, where six people were killed in a power plant, surprisingly enough, that is almost exactly the same output as the Vermont Yankee nuclear power plant, only 50 miles away from there, and it's being built, was being built rapidly in order to come online in time to replace Vermont Yankee because people are working hard to shut that plant down.
Yeah, and you and I have both tried through our blogs to keep these facts more in the forefront of people's consciousness. But unfortunately, you know, it doesn't, you know, a couple of bloggers versus every news organization in the world yapping about Fukushima. You know, it's an uphill battle.
Well, of course it's an uphill battle. This is not easy stuff. I mean, changing the world energy thought processes is not going to happen quickly. And when, you know, people, you know, particularly those who have a background in the high-tech industry where it seems like everything happens so fast, they don't understand just how much time and effort it takes to turn the momentum from one fuel to another, and they don't recognize that even the real renaissance took a couple hundred years. You know,
and that's why I would encourage you, Rod, to look at the fruits of your labor. You know, look at dozens of people that you turned on to this and dozens of people that they turned on to it, and look at that as an exponentially growing bubble of understanding. It seems like it's taking forever right now, but thanks to the internet, thanks to blogs, thanks to this ability, we have an analog to, you know, the printing press back during the Renaissance, when for the first time people were able to mass communicate information. You know, they could write a pamphlet and print it out and hand it out before the king had them all in irons.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we are able to have podcasts and they can be listened to people all around the world. The word is getting out because we have a generation of people growing up right now who have heard the line the whole life that, you know, right around the corner, wind and solar is going to save us. But they're looking around going, wait, whole world's still running on fossil fuels. Something's got to give. I don't think I'm being told the truth. And they're getting online, some of them, and they're finding out about this story about fission is the new fire. They're finding out that there is everything you were told about nuclear was basically wrong. And they're getting excited, and they're wanting to do something about it. So, I mean, I think, you know, there's a lot of good things to be said for what's happening in the world right now.
Oh, I'm a huge fan of the communication capabilities that we have today. I fully recognize the incredible gifts that have been given us in the form of the internet and heck, I started a website in 1995 to try to share what I knew. And the reason I did was because, you know, a young lady who was a student at the time read my paper feeble attempts at using the printing press to try to get the word out. And she said, you know, Rod, you really ought to try to develop a website. And you know, I still am in touch with that young lady who's now not, you know, we're both, you know, 12, 17 years older now, you know, Dr. Sema Bilbao, who's still a very active member of the American Nuclear Society. You know, our ability to communicate is incredible, and so we have to take advantage of it. And you know, people who think that the media control of people's thought processes is going to continue don't have young people in their lives. You know, I have children who, you know, are the Facebook generation. They were on Facebook during their college years when the only people on Facebook were college students. You know, they communicate and they get their news in a completely different way. They never watch the television news, and neither do any of their friends, because they know, you know, those teasers and their commercials and all that other crap. They don't have time for that. They get online, they look at newspapers, they read what they need to read, they talk to people, they share stories, they share pictures, they tell each other you know, what's really happening in the world. And that's the way that people are communicating today, and we got to keep taking advantage of it.
And you're absolutely got right. To get I can't away even remember from this the last idea time that, I watched news on TV.
Yeah, it's incredible. I mean, first of all, you know, the criteria is no longer the Walter Cronkites of the world who were, you know, honest journalists who would never get up and you know, tell a story unless they could verify it themselves. You know, these days the criteria is, what does your face look like? Not how good a journalist you are. It's, do you have a pretty telegenic face? You know, do you have a voice that people want to listen to? You know, that's not a criteria for getting information.
Yeah. Well, that's what helps guys like you and me, you know.
Hey, I've got a great face for radio. That's why I don't do a video podcast. But you know,
Rod, I've sure enjoyed talking with you tonight.
As always, Kirk. And by the way, I'm going to mention it to you and share it with the world. For those of you who recognize my face, because I you know, publish it regularly, it's going to change as a fundraising endeavor. There's a wonderful fundraising program called Movember, and Movember is all about growing a mustache to raise money for men's health. Well, I already have a mustache, so in order for me to participate,
you have to shave yours off.
Exactly. In order for me to participate in Movember, I'm going to be shaving my mustache on Halloween and growing a new mustache back. And I want people to think about maybe making a contribution. I try to, you know, make my website as clean and free of advertising as possible, but every once in a while I'll try to, you know, do a fundraiser. And this is a pretty important campaign, and I'll put up more information about the Movember campaign. And as a matter of fact, my face may even change to I'll grow a mustache and a winter coat back.
Sounds good, Rod. I'm all the best on that.
All right. Take care, Kirk. And I'm going to put it on my calendar. 6 months from today, we're going to get Rick back on the line.
Sounds good to me.
Bye.
Bye-bye.